Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
All right. Well, welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. Tonight, we have Gary Crist here to speak about one of the subjects we all like, which is local history. And his book is Trespassers at the Golden Gate, a tale of love, murder, and madness in Gilded Age San Francisco. Very good read. And entertaining people, what they're up to. So anyway, Gary's going to tell you a little bit about the book, and then we'll have a discussion, and then you guys can ask some questions too. So, Gary.
Thank you. Well, thank you all for coming. I'm really delighted to be here. I know that this is a venerable and much-loved institution in Northern California, so I'm really honored to be here. I was just going to give a kind of quick orientation to the book, and then I was going to show some slides with some narration, and then George and I will have a discussion, and we'll eventually open it up to questions, a question and answer period. So just to sort of orient you, for the past 15 years or so, I've been writing this series of what I call city narratives. These are basically books where I try to tell the larger story of a particular American city. Usually it's some crucial transition time when it goes from being a relative backwater to being a place of some significance. And I try to depict this transition through the personal stories of a limited number of individuals. Sometimes they're famous people. Sometimes they're what you might call semi-famous, which I think these people maybe are. And sometimes they're not famous at all. So I started with Chicago in my book, City of Scoundrels, in 2012. I went to New Orleans in 2014 with a book called Empire of Sin. And most recently, I wrote about Los Angeles in The Mirage Factory in 2018. And so I'm trying to do more or less the same thing with San Francisco in this book. I'm trying to tell a two-tiered story, foregrounding a personal narrative against the backdrop of a changing city and changing circumstances. So on one level, the book is really kind of a classic true crime narrative about one of the most sensational murders in San Francisco history. It's November of 1870. A young, beautiful, already somewhat notorious woman named Laura D. Fair guns down her longtime adulterous lover, A.P. Crittenden, right on a crowded ferry going from Oakland to San Francisco, and she does it right in front of the victim's wife and children. I mean, the crime itself could hardly be any more brazen and scandalous. And the victim was really a well-known San Francisco attorney and California politician. So it was inevitable that the trial would attract a certain level of frenzied attention, at least locally and regionally. But there were several elements to the trial that really made the thing blow up into a kind of national sensation, creating the kind of media circus that ultimately brought into its orbit major national figures like Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Horace Greeley, Mark Twain, and others. For one thing, it was one of the earliest trials in American legal history to hinge on a temporary insanity defense, and I hope we'll talk a little bit about this later on. It was very controversial at the time, and it was something that Mark Twain in particular had a few things to say about. But the trial really raised a number of hot-button social issues of the day, issues that really challenged traditional beliefs about things like the proper role of women in the public sphere, if any, the sanctity of marriage and the family, what you might call the range of socially acceptable expressions of femininity. And what I mean by that is, if you're a respectable woman, there are things you can do and things you can't do if you want to remain respectable. And all of these ideas were very much changing, very much in flux in the years after the Civil War. Because if you think about it, during the Civil War, a lot of women had been forced to perform traditionally male functions because all of their males, their husbands, their fathers, their brothers, were off fighting in the battlefields. And a lot of these women had proven quite capable indeed at these tasks, thank you very much. And so after the war, a lot of women were determined not to go back to the old days of subservience and pure domesticity. They wanted to vote. They wanted to own property separate from their husbands. They wanted to run businesses. They wanted to be out in the world doing things. But this was perceived as a threat, certainly by a lot of men, but also by a lot of women. It was seen as an attack on the basic building block of a stable Victorian society, which was this traditional family where it's the man who is out in the world doing things, and the woman's realm is basically hearth and home. But there was another aspect to the trial that was particularly important to the city of San Francisco, which in 1870 was really trying to finally shed its reputation from the gold rush years as kind of a loose, lawless, socially chaotic frontier town. The Transcontinental Railroad had come to town just the year before, in 1869, and that had brought San Francisco into much closer contact with the mainstream of American life and culture. So there was a whole cadre of what I call community elites, which is like businessmen and politicians and lawyers and things like that, who really wanted to reassure the rest of the country and promote this image of San Francisco as a stable, law-abiding, business-like place that would be safe for your capital investment. So they really wanted to make an example of Laura Fair. To their mind, only a guilty verdict and a death penalty would really send the right message out to the world, and particularly to those Eastern capitalists whose investment the city really needed to continue growing. And that message was basically that the old days of the Wild West are long gone in San Francisco, and the kind of depravity and violence exemplified by Laura Fair, not just her crime, but the whole way she lived her life, the bold way she lived her life, was just not going to be tolerated in this new Victorian city. So there was a lot hanging on the results of this trial. And for me, going back and laying out the full 25-year backstory of Crittenden and Fair that led up to the crime really let me get at a huge swath of San Francisco history from just before the gold rush, when it was a pretty quiet little town of 850 people, to its full flowering as a major metropolis during the Gilded Age. And it's kind of what I've tried to do in all of my city books, which is, tell a personal ground level story, but also tell the larger story of the city. Now, I was going to have a little presentation here, which will give you a kind of background to the story, so that you have a little orientation for the later discussion. Basically, the story is about two people who went to California in the mid-19th century looking for a better Act Two in lives where Act One had not worked out so well. The first was Alexander Parker Crittenden, or AP as he was usually called. He was born in 1816 into a prominent Kentucky political family. As a matter of fact, his uncle was John Jordan Crittenden, who was a longtime U.S. senator and congressman from Kentucky. He was attorney general under two different presidents and was actually talked about as a potential presidential candidate more than once. AP came from a slightly less exalted branch of the family. His father was a prominent Kentucky state politician. But he had a real weakness for financial speculation. And when he died, when AP was just 16 years old, he left the family with debts to the tune of $30,000 to $40,000, which was a tremendous amount, over $1 million in today's dollars. And young AP, very nobly, I think, stepped up and told his mother, look, I will be responsible for paying all of those debts. But really, he would labor under the shadow of that debt for the rest of his life. So about a decade later, he's been working as a lawyer in Texas. He has a wife and family now. He's still deeply in debt. But then he hears of the gold strike in California, and like so many thousands of people all over the world, he thought, this is my big chance. I'll go out there, I'll make a quick fortune, and my life will start over again. So at a certain point, he decides to hoe for California, trying to make that quick fortune. And, you know, they had these groups that would band together and travel out to California together because nobody wanted to do it alone. So in April of 1849, he left behind his wife Clara and their children to join the westward tide of migrants. His marriage had been pretty troubled for some time, mostly over money issues and his inability to provide a comfortable life for his family. But he hoped that, you know, with the easy money to be made in gold-rich San Francisco, he'd rectify all that. He promised Clara that once he'd established himself in the new territory, he'd bring the whole family west. Now that's Clara, second from the right there. She actually, over the course of her life, was pregnant 14 times, gave birth 14 times. Only 8 of them lived to adulthood, but you can see why money was a problem. Anyway, before the discovery of gold at Sutter's Mill in the foothills to the east, San Francisco, which was then called Yerba Buena, seen here about 1846, was a sleepy and remote town with a population of several hundred people. But its days as a backwater were numbered. So remember that image, because you're going to see the image of the city 30 years later, and it will be a remarkable transformation. But anyway, so this sleepy town became the target of all of these people coming west. The rush of gold seekers to California was momentous and chaotic, as people found their way west by whatever means possible. As you can see in this satiric lithograph, where some people are going west on a dirigible, and I don't know, this is like a Victorian rocket ship or something like that. Among the other early arrivals in town was a young William Tecumseh Sherman, later of Civil War fame, who first came to California as a soldier during the Mexican War. In fact, as assistant adjutant general to California's military governor in 1848, Sherman was present in the governor's office when the first specimens of gold from Sutter's Mill was brought in for official inspection. As a matter of fact, he was actually the person who tasted the metal and flattened it with the side of a hatchet to positively identify it as gold. Sherman would leave California after the war, but he would return a few years later as a banker and was amazed at how much San Francisco had grown in just a few years that he was gone. Another early arrival was William Chapman Ralston, the eventual founder of the Bank of California. He came west in 1854 as a 28-year-old agent for one of Cornelius Vanderbilt's steamship lines. He quickly worked his way up the capitalist ladder and ended up really doing more to promote the growth of the city than probably any other individual. A series of 5 major fires swept through the fast-growing town over the space of 18 months in 1851 to 1852. Crittenden himself was almost burned alive by one of them, and he vividly describes it in a letter to his wife. But after each fire, the city would build back with greater care and expense. So the former frontier outpost of tents and wooden shacks very quickly became a modern-looking city of bricks and mortar, advanced enough for Crittenden to finally bring Clara and the children west to live in California in 1852, after just over a little about two years apart. And as a lawyer and state legislator, he eventually managed to give them a comfortable upper-middle-class lifestyle, but always with this ever-growing burden of debt hanging over him. Gold Rush-era San Francisco also attracted a number of African-American and other black migrants, including Mary Ellen Pleasant, a near-legendary figure who managed to amass an extraordinary amount of power, influence, and money, which she put to use in the struggle for civil rights in San Francisco. She and her husband filed suit against San Francisco streetcar companies that refused to carry black passengers. She eventually dropped that S at the end of her surname. She also allegedly helped finance John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry in 1959, though the evidence for that is a little bit shaky. The gold bonanza also brought a multitude of immigrants from other nations, China in particular. Although they were welcomed at first, the Chinese newcomers faced increasing hostility from whites as their numbers grew, especially from Irish immigrants who saw the Chinese as competition for jobs. Sorry to bring that up on St. Patrick's Day, but... And now we come to our second main character. Laura Fair was another dyed-in-the-wool Southerner who came to California fleeing a rough first act. She was twice married and twice divorced before her 20th birthday, something that was considered well beyond the pale of respectability in her New Orleans hometown. And so she left for San Francisco sometime around 1856. But she had a real hard time keeping herself afloat. The whole country had gone into a recession at this point. So for the third time, she tried to marry a wealthy older man, William Fair, who gave her his name and gave her a beautiful daughter. But he turned out to be a little bit of an imposter. Like a lot of people in California at this time, he had padded his resume a little bit, and he was not quite as wealthy and successful as he made out. They had money problems, they were arguing, and pretty soon Laura and the baby had left him, and he committed suicide. And the rumor going around town was that it was because of his wife's constant demands for money and her imperfect fidelity in the marriage. So again, she found herself with a dubious reputation. She had come 3,000 miles to escape it, but now here she was with another one. Ultimately, though, she was able to lift herself out of poverty and debt by putting this notoriety... I had to have a little fun with this. She was able to lift herself out of poverty and debt by putting her notoriety to good use. She went on stage and within a few short weeks had made enough money to turn her life around. She appeared as Lady Teasel in Sheridan's The School for Scandal, which is a role of a young woman who drives her older husband crazy with her constant demands for money and imperfect fidelity. And she was playing opposite Junius Brutus Booth, the brother of John Wilkes Booth, who would go on to assassinate Lincoln. Booth objected to sharing the stage with a rank amateur like Mrs. Fair, especially after she started to get better reviews than he did. Anyway, in 1863, with her newfound wealth, Laura was able to open a lodging house called the Tahoe House in Virginia City, Nevada, where the newly discovered silver-rich Comstock lode was creating even greater opportunities for wealth than the gold rush had 10 years earlier. And one of her first tenants was a certain A.P. Crittenden, who had come to Virginia City for an extended period to take advantage of the lucrative legal work involved in mining claims. He also kind of had to get out of California because 1863, the Civil War had started. He was a Confederate sympathizer, and California passed a law in 1863 saying, if you're going to practice law in California, you have to sign a loyalty oath. And he refused to do that. So he left Clara and the children in San Francisco. He said it was because it was a more civilized place. Virginia City was too rough for a wife and family. And so he went out for an extended period to Virginia City. And in his first interview with his attractive new landlady, he said, "Ah, yes, these rooms will be ideal for an unattached widower like myself." So anyway, Laura would eventually find out that he had a living wife, but not for 6 months. They entered into this affair, and to hear her tell it, they were soon engaged to be married. But Crittenden, for obvious reasons, was not about to get too specific on a wedding date. Anyway, meanwhile, back in San Francisco, as the city matured during the Civil War, a distinctive literary culture developed under the stewardship of short story writer and poet Bret Harte, who is editor of three important publications, The Golden Era, The Californian, and The Overland Monthly, helped sow the seeds of a new Western school of American literature. One of Harte's mentors was the famed orator Thomas Starr King, who during the war enlisted Harte and other writers in his important efforts to drum up support for the Union in California. Many in the state had at one time flirted with the idea of California actually seceding from the Union, either to join the Confederacy or more likely to become an independent Pacific Republic, though it never came to be. And President Lincoln himself would ultimately credit Thomas Starr King for being instrumental in keeping California in the Union. I mean, one of the big surprises in my research was finding out how strong the Southern Confederate influence was in California. As a matter of fact, in 1858, the California legislature voted to split the state in two, have the south side, the south part slave and the northern part free. Fortunately, the U.S. Congress put the kibosh on that. But there was really some concern that California might secede from the Union. But probably the greatest figure in this new literary universe was Mark Twain, who spent just a short time in the city, but left an indelible mark. And I hope we'll be talking more about him later. After the war, both AP and Laura returned to San Francisco, where their relationship was by now an open secret. Local society disapproved, but Crittenden refused to end the affair. He kept promising that he would divorce Clara and marry Laura, but repeatedly found an excuse to delay. After 7 years of broken promises, a sick and distraught Laura had had enough, and on November 3rd, 1870, when it looked as if AP and Clara might reconcile after some months apart, Laura followed him onto the El Capitan ferry from Oakland to San Francisco and shot him dead, right in front of the wife she had long resented and hoped to replace. I apologize for the quality of that, but it was just so perfect that I couldn't not use it. Anyway, the story made headlines nationwide as a narrative quickly developed depicting Fair as a bold, bad woman who seduced an upstanding family man and then killed him when she realized she couldn't have him. What followed was one of the most notorious court cases in American history, spurring controversy and debate nationwide. The trial, a transcript of which was published commercially by the two court stenographers, became a kind of referendum on the moral fitness of the city of San Francisco, which by this point had, in just three short decades, had grown into one of the great cities of the world. This is what the city looked like around 1878, and it's just 30 years later than that earlier picture that I showed you. And that's basically what the story is about, George and I will discuss more issues, and then we'll open it up to questions. But thank you.
Yeah.
You walk around that way.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay.
So my first question is, you've written about the other three cities plus ours. It's all about scandal and how badly things have happened and everything. So I figured you're in a good position to ask this question. So is politics always like in this state of craziness in most places? And if that's true, maybe we could be more optimistic about the future. we're talking about San Francisco here. So, you know, most people are going, what the heck's going on the other coast, you know, since we're on the left coast.
Right.
But it seems if you look at history that lots of crazy things have always happened, and because of the energy and everything, all kinds of things happen that are still all right. So I'm just asking you for a little optimism that we don't have to give up yet.
Well, I'm not sure I can provide. I mean, when people would ask me, you know, what do you want people to take away from your books? I would always say, one thing I want them to take away is the confidence that, you know, we have been through really bad stuff and have survived. So, you know, feel hopeful about that. But recent events have kind of shaken.
No, wait a minute. You should have stopped right there. You said exactly what we were looking for.
Well, we'll see.
All right. So let's go back to reality. Okay. Oh, no, wait. That is reality. Okay. The research you must have done, because I know you say at the beginning of your book that everything, every quotation that you say is the actual words that the people used at the time. And you use a lot of quotations. So you have real words. How did you come across all their real words, and what was the research like? It must have taken a long time.
It did take a long time. This book longer than any of the others. I mean, part of that had to do with COVID, but it's like when people ask, how do you choose the story that you're going to foreground to tell the larger story of the city? Of course, it's got to be a dramatic and compelling story, but even the most compelling and dramatic story is just going to sort of sit there as a kind of sketchy synopsis unless I can really bring it to life with things like dialogue, you know, scenes of confrontation between people, vivid descriptions of places.
They're lying love letters.
Yeah, lying.
They're
love
lying
letters,
love letters.
Right.
That was a really nice addition.
But I'm a nonfiction writer. I used to be a novelist, but I'm a nonfiction writer now, and I hold myself to pretty strict standards of scholarship. Mm-hmm. So I can't invent. I can't embroider. I can't make it up. In other words, so I've got to find all of those novelistic elements, the dialogue and stuff, in the existing historical record, in things like memoirs or court transcripts or personal letters or newspaper interviews and things like that. If I can't find that kind of material in abundance, I can't use the idea, no matter how amazing it may sound in summary. But in this case, I had just a wealth of material, mm-hmm. Probably the richest supply of archival source material I've ever had for any book in my career. First of all, there was this huge court transcript, mm-hmm. now of the murder trial. I think the official transcript it no longer seems to be extant. I have a feeling it was a victim of the 1906 earthquake and fire. But as I indicated, such was the interest in this case at the time that the two court stenographers, I don't know how they were allowed to do this, they published a full verbatim transcript of the entire month-long trial and sold it in bookstores. And it amounted to the equivalent of hundreds of pages of really juicy court testimony that was full of details and things like that. I also had an amazing number of letters. First of all, there were the lying, the intimate love letters, probably dozens and dozens of intimate love letters between Crittenden and Fair, which were admitted into evidence during the trial, and so they were reprinted with the transcript. They were also printed in the newspapers as the trial was going on, and they are extremely embarrassing at times. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure Clara Crittenden was mortified. But I would find letters all over the place, like in an online collection of Civil War letters at the University of Washington. There was this really heartbreaking exchange of letters between A.P. Crittenden and Clara Crittenden, when their son was killed during the Civil War. He was actually executed in the field in Virginia as a Confederate spy. And so that was really wonderful. But the really motherload of information was the enormous Crittenden Family Papers Collection, which is at the Clements Library at the University of Michigan. And that it was, I think, assembled by one of his daughters. And it contains hundreds and hundreds of letters to and from the Crittenden parents, the Crittenden children, the Crittenden aunts and uncles. And all of them were, you know, dishing about what was going on in the family and how Pa, they always called A.P. Crittenden Pa, how Pa was carrying on with that woman and stuff like that. So, you know, with all of this information, there were times where I could tell what A.P. Crittenden was doing on an almost daily basis at certain points in his life. And it was really wonderful sometimes comparing letters from different sources. And so I'd find a letter from that Crittenden wrote to Laura Fair from the trial letters. And then I'd find a letter from roughly the same time of Crittenden to his wife from the family collection. And he was telling them entirely different things about what he was doing. And he was blatantly lying to both of them. So
shocking.
Yeah, really. But so that, you know, that's that kind of, you know, there were times where I just felt like I was a private detective just 150 years too late, but still able to say, I caught you. I know what you're doing.
Now, you said the Michigan papers were at the Clements, something Clements?
The Clements Library, yeah.
That had nothing to do with Samuel
Clements. With a T, no, a T at the end.
Oh, okay, Clements, great. I was going to say, that would have been too weird.
Right, no.
okay, so. Let's talk a little bit about the trial issue, the legal issue. So there was the legal issue about the temporary insanity defense. But there's another element that seemed to be part of the whole trial. Like you said, they wanted the city fathers, not the mothers, but city fathers wanted her to be killed. There weren't too many female murderesses, but they wanted her to be hung for having done this. Right. But she had one trial where she was found guilty, and then that was overturned for different technical reasons.
Right.
In the second trial, she was found not guilty.
Right.
I mean, not you know, like lower down to the level of secondary murder or something so that she wouldn't have to get killed, but it was not guilty all the way. So in a way, it was. I was thinking about it as a lawyer and thinking, well, you know, it seems to me that people have a great difficulty with these crimes of passion. Because you're really not at risk from this person unless they're in love with you.
Huh.
It's a weird thing to say.
Right.
But if they're not in love with you, you have nothing to fear because they're not going to kill you, right?
Yeah.
And so I thought that was not just the temporary insanity, but this other thing, which we always have between first-degree murder and second degree or crimes of passion, and what do we do about those people? Because do we spend all that time keeping them in jail when we really don't have to keep them away from anybody because the person that we have to keep them away from is dead?
Yeah. Although, you know, it's like the defense in her trials kept trying to depict her as, you know, a poor, undefended woman who did not have a male defender, and so she succumbed to the wiles of this crafty lawyer. Meanwhile, the prosecution was taking the opposite thing, saying she was the seductress and, you know, took advantage of his weakness and stuff like that. So there were all these images of Laura Fair going on. But the reason it didn't work in the first trial was because, you know, her lawyers were saying, "Oh, she's defenseless. She, you know, she's a helpless woman. You know, what, you know, what can you expect?" And then she would get up on the stand and she would like give this lucid testimony, obvious intelligence, you know, with sociological analysis about, you know, how it's different for men, for women in our society. So the jury was like thinking, she's not a helpless woman. And I think, you know, and I think that's kind of why they came through with the guilty verdict at first, but then it was overturned by the Supreme Court on a couple of technicalities. And her second defense lawyer was smarter, and he did not put her up on the stand.
Right.
So it became much more believable that she was, a poor victim here.
Right, and you mentioned in your book that Mark Twain made a comment about the jury, because the jury in the second trial as well, they had trouble finding 12 people who had not formed an opinion on this murder because everybody had been talking about it for years.
Right. And
everybody had gone through it all before. So he said, you had to be so dumb that you didn't pay attention.
Right, yeah. I mean, the people
who get on the jury. So
the people who got on the jury were the ones who would say, I don't really read much.
Yeah, right.
I don't really talk about current events with anybody. And so, the prosecution would say yes, both lawyers would say yes because they, dumb juries can be manipulated by either side. and Mark Twain just thought this was ridiculous. And the whole system was designed to produce a jury of 12 cretins, So,
and by this time, he was no longer in San Francisco, but out east writing about that.
But he ended up using the Laura Fair story as one of the subplots in his first novel, The Gilded Age, which he had co-written with Charles Dudley Warner. There's a character called Laura Hawkins, who ends up shooting a powerful man and getting off on a temporary insanity plea.
All right. So one little detail that you had that I thought was fascinating was how A.P. Crittenden got from L.A. to San Francisco. So he crossed the desert. He left Texas. You mentioned the story earlier that he left Texas to make his way out to California. He went the southern route, walked through the desert, he nearly died, all kinds of terrible things. He gets to L.A. He has no more money left. And how does he get to San Francisco? He gets elected to the state legislature.
I know.
And then the state has to pay for his ticket to go up to San Francisco.
Right.
So wonderful.
The election happened 2 weeks after he arrived in town.
Yeah.
But at this point, L.A. was such a tiny place that, he was a lawyer. So he impressed people, and he won with something 250 votes.
Yeah, right. That's all it took to get 250 votes. So he got a free ticket up to San Francisco, basically, was what he did.
Yeah.
I think that's hilarious.
Yeah. I mean, it was still a raw territory at that point. So,
and that was 1949, right? 1949.
Right.
Okay. So now, 1849. Yeah. Thank you.
I always make that mistake.
It's just so long ago.
Yeah.
So in 1861, you have in another part of the book, you have this little fact. In 1861, San Francisco had the highest per capita income of any city in the United States. So we're talking about 1849, 1861, 12 years, went from nothing, and it wasn't all gold. The gold had already played out a little bit by then.
Right, yeah.
But even so, San Francisco now had the highest per capita income of any city in the United States.
Yeah.
That's really amazing.
I mean, everything happened so fast here. Mm-hmm. The city went from 850 to 50,000 in just a few years, in terms of population.
Burned out three times.
Right.
And then got rebuilt with brick.
Yeah. There was a wonderful quote from somebody who said, San Francisco was not born the normal way, but like chickens under heat or something like that. chicken eggs under heat, and that was interesting because the 7-year affair that Laura Fair and Crittenden had, when it started, it was still kind of winked at and stuff like that. It was accepted as it would in a gold rush town, but by after the war, they had these good morals campaigns and things like that. It was perceived as, totally unacceptable. So everything was so telescoped in their history so that a 7-year affair, you can go from being, it's sort of tolerated to being not tolerated, And so,
as you said, one of the things that you said that was really interesting was that you went over it real quickly, but Laura first married at 16, if I remember correctly, married at 16. And that husband she divorced,
Right. Well, he actually died before the divorce.
Oh, he died before the divorce.
But I just tried to keep it a little simple.
Right. Okay. And then the next one committed suicide.
No, the next one.
Oh, the first one committed suicide.
No, the third one committed suicide.
Third one. It's all like
it
that.
It is a little confusing.
But she was like 19 after she'd gotten through quite a bit.
Right. Yeah.
And so, as I said, and she was out with her mother. Her mother was part of this whole story,
right.
And her daughter from Fair when she married him and had the daughter. She was part of this.
Right.
The fact that I thought was really fascinating was A.P. Crittenden's family. So he's got Clara, who's always complaining about things. But they have all these children, and some of the daughters are now adults, and some of the adult daughters were in Virginia City at the same time
right.
that he was having the affair in Virginia City with Laura.
Right.
And then he had sons. Two sons went off to the Civil War. They told the family they were going to go to Europe for school. And
right.
They jumped ship in Cuba and joined the South, right? And one died. But one of the or two of the different sons got crushes on Laura.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was very.
That's a part of the story that.
Yeah. Well,
just gotta hear,
the interesting thing is if you just read the newspapers, which represented establishment wealthy San Francisco, she was a horrible woman, you know, a Jezebel and stuff like that. But then, you know, there's all these reports of how intelligent she was. She was a talented musician. Mm-hmm. She could speak intelligently on so many topics. And so, you know, we're not getting the right story here. And the fact that two of her sons fell in love with her, one of them wrote her Two of his sons, yeah.
One that would have made the story really more interesting.
as if it could be more interesting. He wrote Laura such a flirtatious letter that Laura took it to AP and said, look, you got to talk to this kid.
But she was closer in age to the son.
Yeah, right.
Than she was to the old man, right?
And the older kids knew about the affair long before Clara did. Mm-hmm. Although Clara pretended not to know about the affair for a long time, I think that she thought that was the way to go. But I think she sort of knew that something was up.
Make that clear. The you commented on old man. It reminded me of just one little detail in your book, like the per capita income. You mentioned that a guy died in the 1850s. He was the oldest man in San Francisco when he died. I'm not going to say what the age. How old do you think the oldest man in San Francisco who died in the 1850s was? Just take a guess, somebody.
42.
Pretty close. 47. He was 47 years old. That was the oldest person in San Francisco.
That showed you how, you know, young and...
It's sort of like all those guys running the Silicon Valley, startups, two decades ago. They were all under 25.
Right. Yeah.
All right. So, tell the story of what A.P. Crittenden did to make Laura and his wife and one of his daughters appear in public to try to cover over something that everybody knew.
Right. Yeah. There was this time when AP and Laura were living in Virginia City, and Clara and the children were in San Francisco. And she was hearing stories, and she was giving him trouble. And so he comes up with this idea where I am going to take Laura Fair down to San Francisco. I'm going to introduce her to Clara, and we're going to sit and have dinner together in a public dining room in front of hundreds of people. And so people are going to say, of course this can't be true, that he's having an affair with this woman, because only a crazy man would bring his mistress and his wife together. But that's exactly what he did. Mm-hmm.
It didn't work?
It didn't work. At a certain point, Clara said, claimed a disposition, and she got up from the table and said, I can't eat here anymore. She went upstairs, and Laura eventually went up to join her, but they didn't get along, and so Laura went back to Virginia City. She was supposed to stay in San Francisco for several weeks. So it really didn't work. And my theory is that Crittenden really knew it wasn't going to work. He wanted to flaunt the fact that he had this beautiful mistress and this wonderful family.
Yeah.
'Cause he was that kind of guy. He was a a Democrat in a family of Whigs from a very early age. He was contrary. He didn't like anybody to tell him what to do. And so I think that this was his way of sort of thumbing his nose at San Francisco and say, I can have it. I can have both of them, you know.
Sort of like running the Miss Universe contest?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So one of the little details from the trial that made Clara, I mean, made Laura Fair the maddest was a lie, or maybe not a lie, but whichever, that Clara said at the trial. Of all the things to be made angry about in the trial, it seems like, but this really got Laura, which shows you she was not a meek woman.
Right.
So tell the story of what made her mad.
Well, when Clara was on the stand describing the scene that happened after they had that dinner, and Clara said, oh, I'm not feeling well, I'm going upstairs. And after dinner, Laura came up and visited her. And Clara claimed that at that meeting, Laura got on her knees and started kissing Clara's hand, saying, you've been the only woman who has been nice to me in decades. And when she heard this, Laura got up from the defendant's table and said, that's a lie! as if they were in a Perry Mason episode or something like that. And she ended up getting fined $250 for contempt of court because that was considered, to say that a respectable woman up on the stand was lying, that was really outrageous.
Yeah, and $250 fine is equivalent to $10,000 or something like that.
It's high, yeah.
A lot of money.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that that's what, you know, to present herself as subservient to the wife was what infuriated her. Of all the other things, the murder, all the other things didn't really get her goat, but that really got her goat.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, this was not a meek woman. I also think it's just great. You told the story about how she played, shortly after one of her scandals, she played a woman exactly with that kind of character on stage successfully.
Yeah.
Not too meek either.
One of her friends was a fairly well-known actor who planned the whole thing, and he knew that the reason she was notorious was this, and he was a character that had that seemed to be have the same thing. He knew that was going to make people want to come in droves to see this thing, and he was right. And really, she had been really suffering. She had unpaid bills, and people were suing her. And just a few weeks of performances, she was able to pay off all those old debts and have a down payment on this boarding house, the Tahoe House, which she was in the right place at the right time. Soon she was making $1,000 a month, which was a lot of money back in those days. And, she was investing in mining stocks. So she was a very capable person.
One of the details that came out was, it's like, oh, she's this poor woman who doesn't know what she's doing. But it became clear from some of the correspondence and everything that she was the one that was even better at investing. I mean, A.P. Crittenden was a lawyer who was working. He had all that inside information.
Right.
But even so, she made her own deals and took care of the stuff herself and became rich on that mine. And to become rich on those mining stocks, that wasn't easy because a lot of people lost everything.
I know, really, yeah. Because the markets were manipulated so blatantly by... Yeah.
You had to be on the side of the manipulators.
Right. No, she was very different from how the newspapers wanted to portray her, which is part of what I'm talking about in the book, about how she outraged the conservatives who wanted the traditional Victorian woman, but she was she was assertive when women were supposed to be demure. She appeared to actually like sex when Victorian respectable women were supposed to be sexless. Mm-hmm. She was this entrepreneur. She was this investor. She was an actress, for God's sake. they were really gunning for her because they didn't like this lurch toward modernity that she represented.
Well, the book has got a lot of other characters in it, as you mentioned, and we don't have time to go through all of them, but that's one of the great parts of reading the book, is really interesting characters. But I did think you should talk about two of them, Mary Pleasant, and an Atoy.
Okay.
One of them.
These, yeah, they're kind of co-stars in the book, and they are women like Laura Fair who didn't fit comfortably into the conservative Victorian categories. So Mary Ellen Pleasant was so involved in local politics and things like that that her kitchen was soon called the Black City Hall of San Francisco. And she's a very, very interesting character because she's, you know, she's not Rosa Parks. She's not like an unambiguously admirable character. But
she did get on the streetcar.
Yes. Yeah.
She,
no.
She did the same thing, only earlier than Rosa Parks. She got on the streetcar to try to break down the rules. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's not really all she was up to.
Right. Frequently, people who are underrepresented in the historical record are, you know, like minorities, black, Asian women, things like that, because it's the white men who write the histories. So it's sometimes hard to find reliable information about these characters, but she really was an interesting character, and she didn't take guff from anybody, and she ended up she lived to a ripe old age, and really went from being at the time that she died, she was really regarded as this voodoo queen, you know, who was like evil in some way, but she has been rehabilitated in latter years. Atoy was a Chinese brothel madam who came very early in 52, I think. And she would use the American court system to address the wrongs that she was being submitted to. So if somebody would cheat her or steal something from her, she'd take him to court and win. And this was a time when the Chinese did not use the American court system at all. They settled things among themselves. And all of these people, you know, Mary Ellen Pleasant and Atoy, had a much easier time in the earlier more tolerant incarnation of San Francisco. But, you know, once the Victorianism set in, you know, Mary Ellen Pleasant began to be ridiculed in the popular lore as Mammy Pleasant, you know, a name that she hated. And Atoy went from being a plaintiff in the courtroom to being a defendant when the city and state started passing laws that specifically targeted Asian sex work. So they kind of underline the main theme, which is, you know, all of these people who didn't fit had a harder time as the city grew older, and they're kind of the trespassers of the title, and I mean trespassers as a compliment.
Well, I thought just one other detail about Mary Ellen, that she already had money, knew what she was doing, came here, but even though she had money, she had to kind of hide it,
right?
And she went to work as a maid or a cook for very wealthy families. And then ended up advising with you know, learning from them, advising them and stuff like that, and becoming very important. So she didn't get her bad, first brought down to Mammy and then brought down to Voodoo Queen. That all took place later when they thought we have to change this person's reputation. Very interesting.
Yeah.
So I'll bet you have some questions. Ooh. Oh, yes, you do. Oh. All right. There's mics on both sides. There's one on the end there for first. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, when you talked about the resentment of the sort of white male establishment resenting her success, particularly her business success, I couldn't help thinking of Elizabeth Holmes, you know, who was a very successful girl boss and was brought down. I'm not commenting on her guilt or innocence, but there seemed to be a parallel there about the resentment of a highly successful woman.
I mean, I think we've seen in a recent notable election that the idea of a powerful woman is still considered dangerous to a lot of people.
Just wondered if you could describe the army of researchers that you control or what is your process for getting into this and discovering all this stuff?
I am an army of one. I'm a control freak, so I've never really hired research. I do hire a picture research for a picture researcher for each book. But and during COVID, when archives and libraries were closed, I would contact archivists to digitize certain things, and then they would send it to me. But largely, it's me going to archives with my laptop and just reading around. I do pick the city first, and then find the story. I just sort of it's kind of my favorite part of the process, where I just am reading. I'm reading biographies. I'm reading histories. I'm reading everything I can about the particular city, and waiting for lightning to strike. And then, you know, I always look at people's bibliographies, because sometimes you can find, there are Mary Ellen Pleasant papers, and they're located here in San Francisco. And it's like a detective following a trail through various archives.
Can we ask you which city is scandalous enough to be next on the list?
Well, people have always said, you know, you've spent most of your life in and around New York. Mm-hmm. We had
too much scandal.
A 25. Really, it's such a big topic. I have no idea whether I will actually do it, but I'm starting to think about it.
Tammany Hall is 1,000 pages all by itself.
So. Right. Yeah.
Was a serial philanderer? Had he had other affairs, or was this unique for him?
I think this was unique for him. Yeah, there's nothing in the family papers that indicates that. People always said, "Oh, Pa has an eye for the ladies" and stuff like that, but I don't think he ever really acted upon it until he was in this unique situation where, you know, he's living right next door to this attractive landlady, and his wife and family are a 30-hour journey away. So I think he thought, well, this is an opportunity.
And he's an unattached widower.
Right, yes. And really, to read some of the letters, he was smitten. He was smitten. I mean, there were things that he would say that sounded like a 14-year-old boy under his first, you know, on his first love affair. And he was, you know, he was supposedly this distinguished lawyer.
Which he was, right? I mean, he wasn't.
He was a distinguished lawyer.
Yeah, I mean, when he died.
Oh, when he died,
the bar,
yeah.
The Supreme Court justices, right. Carriers, you know, they all treated him as like one of the top lawyers in San Francisco.
Right, yeah.
So,
with respect to the condemnation and wanting to have Mrs. Fair executed, is there any indication that these leaders and wealthy men were concerned about the women in their lives, because so many had mistresses, and wouldn't this be an object tale?
That's an interesting thought, because yes, like you know, Ralston, I was talking about, he had a mistress, and many of them did. Maybe they thought if they taught Laura Fair a lesson that they would be safe, and they wouldn't have to look over their shoulders every time they got onto a public ferry.
Sort of all the people who in Congress who went after Clinton for having an affair with an intern.
Oh, you know? Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, hypocrisy is as old as history. So,
you know. It's the best part of history, isn't it?
Yeah.
Could you say more about the involvement of Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton in the case?
After the first trial, when Laura Fair was in prison awaiting, she was sentenced, and they actually set an execution date, but they were kind of waiting for the Supreme Court to look at the first trial. Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony came to San Francisco on a lecture tour. It was a national lecture tour that they were going, and one of the local suffragists brought them to the prison, and they sat and they interviewed Laura Fair, and they came out, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton says, "If San Francisco executes this woman, they will never live it down, because this is so unfair. You know, it was all male jury. All men were against her," and stuff like that. They did say, some of the local suffragists were like, totally behind Laura Fair. Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton did say, well, we're not justifying what she did, but, you know, but it was, you know, these were pretty extenuating circumstances. And the way that she had been treated, you know, strung along for 7 years. And she was very ill toward the end. You know, I did believe that. But there was one night when Susan B. Anthony gave a speech, and she was actually hooted off the stage when she said, you know, until a woman can defend herself, I forget exactly what she said, but she was hooted off the stage. And in her diary that night, she said, I have never had an experience like that before.
I have a question. Is Crittenden buried in Colma?
You know, I'm not really sure. I don't know.
Is there a Crittenden grave there, Janice?
Huh.
Oh.
I've gone on tours of it, but I didn't know who Crittenden was then.
Hmm. You know, Crittenden is a fairly common surname, so I think there are a lot of Crittendens around, but... Yeah, I've come across a lot of them. But
you had mentioned that you previously were a novelist, and now you're into nonfiction. If you can explain why you did that, and then are there any nonfiction authors that you kind of pattern yourself or at least admire?
I started out as a fiction writer. My first two books were short story, quiet literary short story collections, and then. My wife got a job at National Geographic, and we had to move down to Washington, so I was ready to quit my job in New York. And so I said, all right, I'm going to write a couple of thrillers. So I wrote a couple of thrillers, and they wanted sequels, and I was done with those characters. I didn't want to write sequels. So, oh, thank you. Yeah. And so I said, all right, I'm going to write a novel just for myself. And so I wrote this very eccentric novel, which takes place in London in 1690 and in New York in 1990, which were similar times of financial mania. And so I spent a lot of time in London doing the research. And that book, it was a novel called Extravagance. It did not do well. And so I was having a boozy lunch with my agent after that, and sort of saying, I just loved doing the research for that book, going to London and going to libraries and archives in London. And he said, well, why don't you do narrative nonfiction? I can probably sell that a lot easier than another novel. And so I did, and I started, and he was right. He was right. I really feel like the kind of nonfiction I do gives me the same satisfaction as the novels, because, you know, I have to think about pacing, I have to think about bringing out characters and stuff like that. So there's that same satisfaction, but, you know, it's a little harder because I have to find that stuff in the historical record, whereas as a novelist, I could just make it up.
Any models? Any models in narrative nonfiction?
I don't know if they're models so much. There was a book that was really important for me by Jonathan Mahler, a New York writer who wrote a book called Ladies and Gentlemen, the Bronx is Burning, which was about New York at the time of the Son of Sam thing. Mm-hmm. And he did what I have since tried to do, which is like keep various strands going, mm-hmm. To tell the story of a whole city. But in terms of other writers of narrative nonfiction, you have a writer right here in San Francisco, Rebecca Solnit, whom I admire tremendously. Her book about Edward Muybridge was great. She's written a book about George Orwell, which I loved. A really interesting book called Paradise Made in Hell, which is about how at times of natural disaster, people come together in a way that it almost creates a little paradise because everybody's being selfless and stuff like that. And she makes a good case for it. I thought that Isabel Wilkerson's book about the Great Migration was incredible. And then there are the David Graham, people like that. Mm. I don't want to say the EL person, Eric Larson, because when I wrote a Chicago book, every single review compared me to Eric Larson. Sometimes favorably, sometimes favorably. It's like, oh my God, this guy is like peering over my shoulder. But actually, I don't think The Devil in the White City is that good a book, but I think he has written much better books since then. Mm-hmm. And before then, his book about the Galveston hurricane, I thought was excellent.
Mm-hmm. All right. I think we have time. Maybe one more question. Mm-hmm. Another question out here.
What was the story that didn't make the cut?
Well, there was another very big trial. This one actually involved Mary Ellen Pleasant. It involved a woman named Sarah Althea Hill, who claimed that she had been married to William Sharon, who was a co-director of the Bank of California, and he was a bad guy. It was another one of those trials of the century. And I'm a good friend with a writer called Abbott Collar. I don't know if you know her name. But I was sitting down and she said, well, we're both working on San Francisco books. What are you working on? So I said, well, I've just started doing research about this one trial. And she looked at me and said, Gary, I'm doing that story. But she ended up not doing it. So I may go back to it. But yeah, there are all kinds of reasons not to do. And it's usually not having enough archival information.
One more? Okay.
Yes, please. For those of us who haven't read the book, and maybe you don't want to give this up, but what's the denouement? What became of Laura and what
Well,
perfect.
I was reluctant to give spoilers, but then the Wall Street Journal reviewed the thing about a week and a half ago, and they spilled every possible bean not possible. She was finally acquitted, and people were happy about that until they realized she was not even going to go to prison for any time. She's not going to be, you know, put away in an institution for even 6 months. And meanwhile, she was supposedly temporarily insane. She just walked free. She had promised that she would go back to New Orleans, but she stayed in San Francisco. And she was very boldly going around town with a pistol in her purse still.
Did you ever shoot anybody again?
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
She didn't fall in love then?
No. And, you know, after about... I don't know how many years, when the Bank of California almost failed and Ralston committed suicide, maybe, we don't really know. Basically, her affairs were so tied up with William Ralston's affairs that she lost basically all of her money, and she quieted down significantly when she had no money. And she just lived on in San Francisco for decades. Every once in a while, on an anniversary of the trial or of the verdict, there would be an article in the Chronicle that says, oh, you know, Laura Fair is still living in San Francisco. She's looking older these days. and she actually lived till 1919. So she lived through the earthquake and fire, you know.
So if you're looking for a reward like that, make sure that you go out and commit a crime like that.
The key to a long life.
Yeah, exactly. But make sure you get good lawyers who won't put you on the stand. I just love that.
Right.
All right. Well, that was just great, Gary. That was fantastic.
Thank you. Thanks to you all for coming.
And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in our 124th year of enlightened discussion. Did I get that right? Thank you very much, and come again.
You've been listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher. If you like what you've heard, please consider supporting our work and help us bring 500 programs a year to listeners like you. Go to commonwealthclub.org/donate. Think your way around the world with our travel programs to exciting domestic and international destinations. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live at our events. Thank you for listening and for your support.